Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. You got supply and demand as an economic fundamental, wages and inflation as well, to name just a handful. Oh, and also the rule of law. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, today, the 20th day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to pick up with our series that we're running about the people who make this economy go in just a couple of minutes. But we are going to start on this Thursday with a phrase that has been in the ether of late, and specifically the idea it represents. Rule of law, of course, is what I'm talking about, and President Trump's actions and attitudes toward it, most recently his interaction with the Justice Department and federal sentencing guidelines for a buddy of his. The politics gets most of the press. I mean, what else is new, right? But we underestimate the economic underpinnings of the rule of law at our peril. Tori Taussig is a research director at the Belfer Center at the Kennedy School at Harvard. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Kai.
This is going to sound a little basic. It's going to sound a little bit like I'm just a bill, just a little old bill sitting here like Schoolhouse Rock. But give me the primer on the rule of law in this economy in the past, you know, couple of hundred years. It's a thing, right?
It's a thing. I mean, the United States is a country that is founded on the rule of law. We have the oldest democratic constitution in the world. The rule of law is what makes us an advanced democracy, and it is also what allows the United States to be the most favorable destination of foreign direct investment in the world.
Is it fair for me to say then the rule of law is what lets us be an advanced economy as well?
Absolutely. Rule of law and economic development go hand in hand. For an economy to develop and to prosper, there needs to be the foundations of solid rule of law and an understanding that our economy is not at the whim of political officials.
Could you give me some examples of other economies, not as advanced as ours, where rule of law is still up in the air as those economies try to fundamentally get to where we are?
We'll give you two very different examples. First, let's go to Central Europe, where we have relatively new democracies such as Poland and Hungary that, since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, have become more free and prosperous democratic mm-hmm. countries. However, more in their infancy, rule of law is in question, particularly in the last few years, as we've seen the governments in Poland and Hungary kind of attack their independent judiciaries, attack independent judges, and call into question favorable business environments. Companies questioning whether their investments, whether their operations are safe in a country if bankruptcy law, for example, is no longer free mm-hmm. from political influence. Second, let's go to Asia. Look at China's economy. The Chinese Communist Party wields tremendous influence. And there we see businesses dealing with very different types of challenges. For example, it's a very prosperous market for international companies mm-hmm. to be involved in. However, when companies go to China, there's concerns over intellectual property theft. And so rule of law fundamentally in China drives companies and investors' decision-making. And so the United States is on a very different playing field, of mm-hmm. course, when we look at the rule of law and democratic standards. But if even relatively speaking, if we look at the trends that have taken place under the Trump administration, there are certainly questions and concerns for future economic implications.
Yeah, there's an important point to be made here, right? It's not that things are at risk of this instant, but I wonder if erosion of the rule of law as it affects economic development is a little bit like a financial crisis, or I think it was Hemingway who talked about going broke, right? You do it very slowly, and then it happens all at once.
I think the bigger, more important issue for me here, is particularly pertaining to the Trump administration, it's just the level of political instability and geopolitical risk that this administration has caused, which, as we know, historically and in times of financial crises and otherwise, drives investor uncertainty. If you're unclear about whether a cabinet official, whether it's Treasury or state, is going to be in their job, his or her job, the coming week, that creates instability and uncertainty. A second example of this, this type of instability that we see coming from the Trump administration, is in President Trump's kind of quick action use of tariffs. I mean, if you're a company and you sell into the United States and President Trump from one day to the next threatens tariffs on your company's exports to the United States, that immediately calls into questions costs and pricing of that company's global supply chain. Over time, that calls into question the kind of favorability of the U.S. economy to invest and to sell in.
Tori Tosig is a research director at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Kennedy School at Harvard. Tori, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kai.
There was a little bit of uncertainty on Wall Street today. Proximate cause unclear. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are, says the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 164 million people in the American workforce. That's a lot, right? So when we decided to do a series about the jobs those people do and who those people are, we had to get creative. So we crunched some BLS data, we dug into the demographics, and we came up with 10 profiles of people we thought would fit the bill to represent the rest of us. And then we went out and we found those actual people because they are the ones making this economy work. But is this economy working for them? This is our series, The United States of Work.
There's always things that you don't like about your job.
You work hard for what you want.
You know, every job has your ups and downs.
Whatever good job means.
I like the hustle. I like working fast.
It's not a career. It's a lifestyle.
We're in the Central Time Zone today. Nashville, Tennessee. The Belcourt Theater, an independent movie house.
I mean, the movies don't start for a while.
Run as a nonprofit.
So this is a projection booth.
Stephanie Silverman is in charge.
We're in the middle of a noir festival right now.
That's her.
It's real movies on real film.
Stephanie's 49. She's the executive director, which puts her in the same category as Michael, the CPA we met on Tuesday, management, professional, and related occupations. 4 out of 10 of us are, in fact. So question one, how she came to be running the Belcourt.
Well, it was a slightly circuitous route, but, you know, I was a kid who loved the arts. I had a mom who was a musician in an orchestra, so I played the violin and then kind of realized that as much as I loved all this, I wasn't the most amazing violinist. And out of college, really started working for some smaller arts nonprofits, but mostly in the contemporary dance world for a long time. And so, though I had no background in the movie business at all, when I moved to Nashville, where my husband was, he's a musician, so Nashville, of course.
Of course.
This job came open, and well, I didn't really know much about exhibiting movies. I did know a good amount about building audience for challenging, interesting work, and that seemed to be a solid enough through line. And so, here I am now. 13 years later.
So that gets me to my next question, which is, I'm going to make a very rough comparison here, right? The executive director is in essence, the CEO, right? And you're flying above
Definitely.
This, right? So
yep.
What are the bigger economic issues on your mind besides programming the movie house?
Well, you know, as always, it certainly is things like, oh, you know, people's available income. Mm-hmm. You know, I think right now, it's partially because of the city that we live in, Nashville is experiencing unbelievable growth. I mean, that's been wonderful on one hand because it's allowed for the growth of the Belcourt and for our success and for our great growing audience numbers. But it comes with it all those adjacent challenges. most importantly, I would say right now, is affordable housing for the people who work at the theater. Nobody makes $1 million working in an independent film house. And particularly for our front of house staff in a city like Nashville, they're mostly working artists. So they're just getting pushed further and further and further outside of the city. And I really worry that we're driving that community to the outskirts or to different cities, ultimately. Mm-hmm. And we're going to lose something that really is the heartbeat of this community that we all love.
You know, it's interesting because you talk about the folks who work there as this is basically a side hustle for them, getting them, you know, steady income relating to their other, most of them working arts jobs. And it occurs to me you're married to a musician. And while Nashville is probably a great town for like studio musicians and the rest, you're probably the breadwinner, right?
Yeah, you know, it's I guess it's a little bit like having a spouse in real estate or something, right? Where years ebb and flow. So yeah. He's been a real working musician for his entire adult life. So he's never had a side hustle, I guess, unless like teaching at a university is considered that. But you know, he is teaching violin. You know, it.
Wait, you're a violinist and you're married a violinist?
Yeah, isn't that? But he's a good violinist and I am a bad violinist. Okay. So there's no competition left.
Fair enough.
We did briefly, when our older kids were younger, we had a family string quartet where I had to play the violin because he had to play the cello on a low instrument. And anyway, it was mortifying and I will never do it again. I will never play the violin in front of him.
Fair enough. But back to the point.
Yeah. But so, you know, I think what is different is that his years are much more mercurial than mine. So some years there's great, wonderful work doing really well-paid things, and some years less. And at least what I contribute is just a steady state, which has been helpful because we do have kids and we live in a city that's getting more expensive. And you know, it's ended up being a good sort of balance for us.
Are y'all doing all right? I mean, do you have extra money that you can put away or are you struggling?
We don't have extra money we can put away right now, but that is because we are on the third college tuition round of four kids.
Yeah.
So two are all the way through. One is, midway through his sophomore year. We got one more down the pike, but he's only 13. So all of our income that is not for the mortgage and food and those other core things really has gone into college for a long time now.
I hear you. Believe me, I hear you. but what would happen then? And I don't want to turn this dark, but it's kind of relevant because you never know in arts and you never know in this economy. What happens to you if the Bell Court had to close down tomorrow and you lost this job?
Oh, well, wow, that would really suck, most of all. But, you know, I have a set of skills that are applicable in other arenas. I've raised a lot of money. I've organized a lot of people. I've built teams, and I've overseen an institution that has grown a lot. So I have skills that I think could move over into other areas of the economy. That being said, I am an almost 50-year-old woman, and I have heard from friends who have been in that situation that it's hard to be a woman who's almost 50 out in the job market right now. So, I have a lot of confidence in my skills and in the things I bring to organizations, and I think I have a track record of being good at what I do. I would not be excited about having to go out and sort of, you know, vulnerably search for a new job.
That was Stephanie Silverman. She's the executive director of the Bell Court Theater in Nashville, Tennessee. Coming up tomorrow in our series, Different City, Different Line of Work, Same Love of the Job.
Growing up, like seeing these buildings get built and I'm finally being a part of one is what got me most excited about coming to work.
We've got more about the United States of Work and all the people we are telling you about and how we found them on our website, marketplace.org/work. Coming up.
The good death isn't as easy as you might think.
It's not cheap either. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 128 points today. 0.4% closed at 29,219. The NASDAQ shed 66.6 tenths%. 9750 is the number there. The S&P 500 down 12 points, about 0.3%. Ended at 3373. Let's do some apparel, shall we? American Eagle Outfitters? Outfitters rose 5.3%. Abercrombie & Fitch was up more than 1% today. The Gap, which announced it's getting into the resale business, by offering customers shopping credits for turning in their secondhand clothing items, it banked 1.6% today. KFC announced today it's launching a chicken and donut sandwich nationwide on Monday, but only for 3 weeks. No explanation of why it's doing that either. Yum Brands, parent company of KFC, and also Taco Bell and Pizza Hut, down more than 1%. Don't at me, guys. Come on. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, y'all. It's Rima Khreis, host of Marketplace's podcast, This is Uncomfortable. And I'm here to tell you that we are back with a new season. Each week, we take a look at how money influences everything from our romantic relationships and friendships to our identities and the jobs we go after. New episodes every Thursday.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The corporate news of the day now, which comes in two main flavors, banking and retail. I guess we'll do banking first. Does that work for you guys? Morgan Stanley is one of the biggies banking-wise, an investment bank that caters to wealthy clients and institutional investors. E-Trade is not that. It's an online brokerage that serves Americans with, shall we say, more modest assets. Anyway, the former is buying the latter for $13 billion, but why? Marketplace's Jack Stewart is on it.
The trading business has seen a lot of pressure on its profit margins in recent years, and that's driving a lot of consolidation. Interest rates are low, and there's been a rush to zero on trading fees. James Choi at the Yale School of Management says it's now a numbers game. Get customers in the door, and then
you can upsell them on these other services like financial advice that will allow you to make some money on them.
So that's one thing Morgan Stanley gets from E-Trade, 5.2 million new client accounts. Some of them will be the attractive Henrys, high earners, not rich yet. Morgan Stanley could entice them into its robo-investing platform, which advises customers through algorithms instead of expensive humans. Drew Pascarella at Cornell.
Morgan Stanley now has the ability to deliver that digital advice to another $360 billion worth of client account money.
Buying E-Trade also allows Morgan Stanley to expand its lucrative business line of managing stock options for employees who are given them as part of their compensation, something they can still charge fees for. And focusing on retail customers could help Morgan Stanley diversify away from its more traditional institutional clients, says Pauline Bell at CFRA.
That is a very lucrative type business, but it is very business cycle dependent. So in order to bring more recurrent cash flows, you do have to pivot into retail space.
Morgan Stanley's E-Trade acquisition is the biggest by a Wall Street bank since the financial crisis. So Bell says she'll be watching to see how regulators react. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
All right, retail now in the corporate embodiment of a company known as L Brands. That name perhaps does not ring a retail bell for you, but hang on, because it will. L Brands said today it is planning to sell a majority stake in Victoria's Secret to a private equity firm. Once upon a time, L Brands had Abercrombie & Fitch, The Limited, Lane Bryant, a bunch of others as well. Now, though, all it's got left is Bath & Body Works. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra looks at the last company standing in the L Brands retail universe.
Becky Starring, who's 35 and lives in Milwaukee, has been shopping at Bath & Body Works since she was 16, and her favorite scent was warm vanilla sugar.
It smells like a warm sugar cookie, which is exactly how I described it to my daughter at the store yesterday.
Now her favorite is the more enigmatic scent, A Thousand Wishes.
I don't really know, like, what it is, but just the aroma of it is kind of like relaxing for me.
And so is the price, $13.50 for an 8-ounce bottle of lotion. Starring goes to Bath & Body Works every few months, and she says when she walks into the store, it looks a lot like it did when she was 16. The colorful displays, the Try Me stickers on the bottles.
I mean, the experience overall is pretty fun to smell all the different candles and the different scents of lotion.
The experience. You know, that thing analysts keep saying retailers need to offer to get people off their couches and into stores. John D. Morris at D.A. Davidson says Bath & Body Works has been in the experience game for a long time because you can't smell things through the internet.
They were one of the first to really allow people openly on their own to do self-tryout. And so people know and understand that, and that's a reason that makes them more of a destination in the mall.
The company is seeing double-digit sales growth at a time when many other mall-based retailers are struggling. Also, while Bath & Body Works' stores haven't changed all that much since Becky Starring was 16, the fragrance business lends itself to a different kind of evolution. Lorraine Hutchinson is an analyst at B of A Securities.
You know, they launch a lot of new scents, and people really love the newness.
All that said, now that Bath & Body Works is the last L Brands property, it'll be saddled with the more than $5 billion of debt that's on the company's books. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
This is a little grim, I know, but dying is a business, and keeping people comfortable as it happens is a better than $19 billion a year business in this country. That's the 2017 figure for Medicare spending on hospice. It's according to the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization. The Medicare Payment Advisory Commission says hospice has become the most profitable part of healthcare services as investors push for growth of their investments. But with more people choosing to die at home, there are some business model questions. Blake Farmer from WPLN in Nashville has that story.
There's an annual tradition at a live hospice in Nashville, a butterfly release to honor those who've died. 8-year-old McCoy Fortner opens a triangular box containing a dormant monarch.
You can also whisper to it to tell the person in heaven what you want to say.
He holds it on his forefinger until the black and orange wings perk up.
Thank you for being my best dad.
His father died of cancer in 2017. His mom, Alicia Fortner, stands behind her son with tears in her eyes. The experience with their nonprofit hospice exceeded expectations. She just wishes they'd move sooner from trying to treat his illness to keeping him as comfortable as possible at the end.
I didn't realize that hospice could be a longer-term thing.
What the Fortners learned is a lesson that's fueled rapid growth of hospice that provides this kind of end-of-life comfort care. Hospice has become the norm, says Ido Bannock of the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization.
We've actually done a pretty good job as a society and as a community of getting it to be that over half of people die on hospice.
The whole healthcare system has aligned to push people into hospice earlier. Hospitals can have their Medicare payments docked if seriously ill patients return over and over. Hospice agencies set patients up, often at home, with a hospital bed, pain medication, and equipment like oxygen. They send out nurses, health aides, and social workers who support family caregivers. Medicare pays agencies nearly $200 a day, and investors have found it a good business to be in. Bannock's organization increasingly represents for-profit hospice agencies, which account for much of the growth. He acknowledges some agencies are cutting corners.
I want to make sure that people are getting the best care possible, and whether the money that's left over goes to shareholders or goes to a community foundation is secondary, quite honestly.
And yet, even when hospice agencies are doing all that's required by Medicare, it often leaves a lot of the work to families. Government data reveals that in-person help from agencies amounts to just a few hours a week on average. Some end-of-life experts are beginning to see the true costs of putting families in charge of the deathbed.
It made me realize how naive I, the doctor of death, was.
Jessica Zitter is an intensive care physician in Oakland, California, who wrote a book about needlessly suffering in the hospital. She's now an evangelist for palliative care, which is the core of hospice. Zitter started working on a documentary about a husband who took his wife, who had cancer, home to die. It didn't go as planned.
And this is this beautiful love story of these two people. And it starts to be, you hear him say, I didn't sign up for this, you know?
The husband, Rick Tash, becomes overwhelmed from managing his wife's morphine doses to getting her to the toilet every few hours. Zitter sits him down at his kitchen table several weeks in.
Asking for more support from hospice if you need it is really important.
What they offered me was a volunteer for 2 hours one day a week.
That's it?
That's what they offered.
Medicare requires agencies to provide aides to help with a few baths and nurses for check-ins. That leaves everyday caretaking and many tasks that would be handled by professionals in a hospital or nursing home to the family. And that can work if hospice lasts a week or two, but the average is now 2.5 months.
The good death isn't as easy as you might think. So we've got to put some more things in place here to make it more likely that people can achieve that.
But in-person help is the most expensive thing hospice covers. Agencies say they can only do so much for $200 a day. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which is, I am completely certain this week's sign, the apocalypse is upon us. McDonald's has some new swag it's offering, because merch is everything, right? You can buy quarter-pounder mittens, that's fine. A quarter-pounder t-shirt, that's fine, too. I mean, basically harmless. Also, though, a set of 6 custom-scented candles inspired by quarter-pounder ingredients, to wit, a candle for bun, ketchup, pickle, cheese, onion, and 100% fresh beef burned together, the company advises, for maximum deliciousness. I've got 2 thoughts. Number 1, late-stage capitalism, am I right? Number 2, and this is really the serious one, how did they not do French fries? All right, we're out of here. Dow Industrials off 128 today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ down 66.6 tenths%. The S&P 500 off 12, that is 0.3%. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, and John Gordon are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.